This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. On the program today, we will talk with Lauren Cross, who's with the Times of Northwest Indiana. She had an exclusive conversation with former FBI Director James Comey ahead of Comey's visit as the first speaker in the Sinai Forum series for Purdue Northwest this year. We'll find out more about the conversation with Comey and other things. We also have our conversation with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch, as well as with Ken Davidson, who is the man who created the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog. That and more coming up on Reporters Roundtable Thursday. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll start off Reporters Roundtable Thursday with a conversation with Lauren Cross from the Times of Northwest Indiana. Lauren, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's certainly a pleasure.
Well, the opportunity to talk with you here is great because we know that you had an exclusive, gave us all an opportunity to take a look in the newspaper as well as online of your conversation with former FBI Director James Comey. How did you, first off, line up a conversation with him, and what's so important about him coming into Northwest Indiana?
Right. So, you know, honestly, we worked with his publicist with the Washington Speakers Bureau to get that lined up, and, mm-hmm. you know, the Sinai Forum also helped organize that as well. You know, to be honest, I didn't know what to expect. You know, I thought maybe this could be a conference call with other reporters, maybe with his publicist, maybe with the Sinai Forum, and I found out it would be a one-on-one and that we had about 30 minutes. One-on-one. So it was definitely a fascinating experience. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, there's a reason why we interviewed him. You know, he's going to be at the Sinai Forum September 9th. He's opening up the Sinai Forum at Purdue and University Northwest in Michigan City. And it should be quite an interesting speech, I think. I really do. I'm looking forward to it.
I know that in your story that you mentioned that he told you that it's not his goal to change anybody's mind or their personal political leanings. So I suppose it's just a way to get people to wake up and pay attention.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, he says, you know, he doesn't care what people's views are on guns, taxes, immigration. But really, he just wants people to think about, you know, really what to value above those policies. And that's truth. That's you know, equal protection, freedom of religion, freedom of expression, and really just what makes an ethical leader. And it's just really interesting. And I'm sure he'll talk about the Trump administration. I'm sure he'll talk about his firing because everyone wants to, you know, they've heard of it, you know, probably 1,000 times at this point by the Washington Post and the New York Times. But to see that face to face, you know, and in person, I think it would be quite a fascinating experience.
I love the quote that you have in there that he gave you in the conversation, his characterization of our democracy.
Are you talking about which one? The messy and wonderful
messy
democracy?
And wonderful, yeah. That's
yeah.
How best to describe this wonderful system of government that we have, to be sure. And also too, I know, and I've heard some other, and you probably have too, the conversation that and explanation he had because Mr. Comey is so tall. He's 6'8" tall. you can't walk into a room and disappear if you're that tall. And I know that there's been some instances. I guess he had an instance when he was still working as the White House staff about
right.
He tried to hide from the president at the time.
Right, next to it. He tried to blend in with, I think, a window curtain. It didn't work out, though. Apparently, since he's written his book and went on the book tour, it's still happening, you know, all over the place. He's 6'8". And I think if I had met him in person, I would have been blown away because I'm, like, just shy of 5'3". So
well,
it would have been quite interesting.
Now, I understand that his speech is going to be entitled The Ethical Leader, and you've kind of mentioned a little bit about what he's going to talk about here. He obviously has a great experience in public service that he's able to draw from, and do you get the impression in the conversation that you had with him that he's going to be able to tie all of that together very well with what he's going to speak at the Sinai Forum next month?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, I think he's going to talk about his extensive career in law enforcement. I mean, he not only served with Trump, you know, he served as an FBI director under three presidents, Bush, Obama, and Trump. So, I mean, he has a lot of experience leading the nation's law enforcement, and also he, you know, was a prosecutor, attorney. I think he is going to nicely tie that in with, you know, the current events of today. And again, everyone's really looking forward to hearing what he has to say about that, especially with, you know, the recent firing at the FBI, Peter Strzok, and the resignation of Lisa Page, you know, Andrew McCabe was a few months ago. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be really fascinating to see how he ties that all together. I'm sure he'll talk about his book, A Higher Loyalty. It's going to be really interesting. Yeah. You know?
One of the things I know, too, that you had in your story in the Times is, I guess, kind of a follow-up as well as to what people here in Northwest Indiana seem to be thinking about Mr. Comey's visit coming up here. You had a chance to talk with the Sinai Forum Executive Director Leslie Klesak. What kind of information have you gotten from her as to how the response has been, obviously, in getting these tickets sold for the event?
Right. So right now, I think as of earlier this week, there's only a handful of single event tickets left for Comey's event. But typically what they do is they sell these Sinai Forum tickets as a series. You know, I think there's a total of five speakers. So they're actually sold out entirely for the series this year. They sold out pretty quickly as well. And, you know, I think, that's partly because of Comey. But I think Leslie Klesak, she also said that the reason why Comey decided to be part of the Sinai Forum is because of its reputation. You know, it's had quite its lineup of speakers over the years, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt, Oprah Winfrey, Mike Dick, Walter Cronkite, and it's definitely a testament of how amazing this forum really is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I know. And I know in talking with Leslie in the past, you mentioned about mm-hmm. that she relies a lot in the advice and the help of the Washington Speakers Bureau for some of the people that are brought in to be speakers in the series in past. And she likes the fact that and you say it's that reputation that the Sinai Forum has in the giving a speaker an opportunity to talk about what it is they'd like to talk about it. And the questions and the response they get from the people and the give and take, I guess maybe you could call it, mm-hmm. and that from the audience as well, when it's time to answer questions, that seems to kind of gear everybody up for a good day, to be sure, for the speech. The impression I got, too, in the article, talking not only for what Mr. Comey's going to talk about the book here and some of the events, of course, of late, also is something to watch as well, too, is, his attitude about, I'm sure, the latest things you mentioned about the firings at the FBI, people that he no doubt knew very well. And I'm sure that he'll probably have something to say, probably almost up to the minute, I would imagine.
I would think so, yeah. And I think that's what everyone's looking forward to. You know, back when I first interviewed with Leslie at the Sinai Forum back in April, when it was first announced, I asked her, what's Comey going to talk about? You know, and at that time, it was kind of hard to say, you know, because the news is happening so fast, especially under this administration. You know, there's so many firings, and you have Trump's potentially looking at his security clearance now, Comey's security clearance. You know, he's considering taking that away. So I think he's going to have a lot to say about what's really happening in the White House these days. It's going to be really fascinating.
And I was wondering, too, in the fact that we've already had former Director Brenner's losing his security mm-hmm. clearance. Who knows, by the time that the Comey shows up in Northwest Indiana, he may have lost his too. We don't know what's going to be happening at the White House about that, I would imagine.
Right. It's going to be very, very interesting. And one thing I wanted to point out too is that, you know, regardless of political leanings, I think most everyone in the audience is going to have some kind of takeaway with Comey. Mm-hmm. You know, because he does say that, you know, we should judge our leaders not by their policies but by their honesty, and we have to insist that they not lie to the American people. And I think that's really the central theme of his central theme speech that day. And I think anyone can really take away from that.
We're talking with Lauren Cross of the Times of Northwest Indiana about the stories that she's written and published, not only in print but in the newspaper as well, too. One of the other stories, too, we wanted to cover today, Lauren, as well, was the latest that you had checked out about, a story maybe that makes one a bit queasy. Certainly makes people in the studio queasy to talk about. And we're talking about some problems at a Hammond Medical Transfer Station. First off, for people that are not familiar with what that operation might be, tell us more about this operation and why it seemed to be back in the news again.
Yeah, so So just to put it simply, a medical transfer waste station, it's basically a location where you transfer medical waste from one truck to another. It's a transfer station. This is a operation by Medisure Services, whose Midwest office is based out of Indianapolis. They've been operating at this Summer Street facility since 2014, but has no city business license to operate, and they never received the proper zoning from the city, which is really fascinating. So this medical waste, so what prompted this investigation is they found basically a container and with blood oozing from it that was in the back of a semi-trailer. And that kind of prompted this wider investigation into, okay, why is this here? And they found out that Medisure has been operating there for a few years now without any knowledge of the city officials. It's a really fascinating story, and there's going to be quite a number of follow-ups, I'm sure.
That's interesting. What is the city had to say about this now? I know that we've gotten the building department now involved in looking into this. I'm sure they were rather quite shocked to know that this business did not have any license at all, I'm sure, to be able to operate in the building. I'm sure it's a commercial industrial slash zone anyway. I've been along that route, and I know that there are a lot of very nondescript-looking buildings, and it's hard to tell what kind of business might be in there if they don't have signs outside. I can see why this one might blend in probably pretty well, only to everybody's detriment, not theirs, but to the city's, to be sure.
The city did, they did say that, you know, the property is zoned industrial, and that's an area, like you said, that's been historically used for heavy industrial uses. The only issue here is that they required a conditional zoning permit based on exactly what they're transferring. They're transferring potentially hazardous material, so naturally, the city would want to know about that. I mean, you know, you're looking at, like I said, potentially hazardous material. That's something the city, especially the fire and police department, should be made aware of. And the only way to accomplish that is to have that zoning and business license on record with the city. Let's say there's an emergency that happens there. You know, the city said, we don't want anyone walking in blind to that. That's entirely dangerous to have their fire department walk in blind.
Yeah, and I know that Ron Novak, who's the fellow who's in charge of the City of Hammond's Environmental Management Department, very concerned, and he actually, I guess, did have a conversation with somebody with Medisure about it?
Yeah, he basically said that, you know, what happens here if we have an incident and police and fire code enforcement's called out, they don't know what they're walking into. Nobody likes surprises, and, you know, he's concerned about, obviously, obvious biohazards at this location. I guess, you know, some of the questions that I still have is, you know, I'm still waiting to hear back from the city on the their final list of codes and environmental violations that the company's facing. I also need to reach out to IDEM because they're involved. You know, they're I don't know how involved they are at this juncture. And then there's the question of whether the property owner should face any penalties for allowing his property to be used outside of proper zoning. You know, it's really curious, like, who's ultimately responsible for this, because the Medisure is only renting this facility.
Yeah. Now, how much responsibility or how much trouble, I should say, would Medisure be in, aside from the property owner itself, if for these violations? Do we know yet?
Yeah, so I don't know the full list right now, but as Ron Novak mentioned, under their ordinance, the fine for the first two is $2,500, and then $7,500 for the remainder, and you're looking at possibly, you know, 2-3 years of violations. And I think Ron Novak kind of suggested to them, you know, if you get out of here, if you move out as expeditiously as possible, that would be taken into account. So really, you're looking at, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. And then you also have IDEM, who has the ability to fine them as well. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens here with this company.
The final story I'd like to check with you about, Lauren, is the one that you put in the Times here recently. It's following up on some things that happened in one of the Michigan City School Board meetings, and I guess it's a concern that a school board member had about the possibility that maybe some residents and facilities in her community were very, very concerned about lead poisoning. And we know there's a lot of problem, of course, in East Chicago and related communities, but it's, I guess, hard to imagine that it would spread so as far as Michigan City. Tell us what you found out there, and what's the result now so far?
Yeah, so, you know, the Michigan City School Board, they had a proposal on the agenda. It basically would have required incoming kindergartners receive lead poisoning screenings. Board member Deborah Chubb, that was her suggestion to the board. And I see both sides here. You know, Ms. Chubb, she obviously understands that Michigan City has a high, disproportionately high number of children with elevated blood lead levels, but it's really impossible to know the true extent of that without testing requirements. And, you know, it is a proactive approach. It's very progressive. You know, not a lot of cities in the state, or a lot, I'm sorry, a lot of school boards in the state require lead testing, you know, for incoming kindergartners. So it would be quite fascinating to see that kind of data play out. You know, that was her goal here, and the intent was there. But at the same time, I see the board president, Don Delaney, I see his side. I see his point of view that it's logistically difficult. It's something that has to be thought out, and perhaps a delayed rollout is more feasible. But I think at the end of the day, regardless of how it's rolled out, I think it needs to happen, at least in some regard. You know, lead paint is a big culprit behind Michigan City's high percentage of blood children with elevated blood lead levels, and you really don't know how bad it is until you require testing.
Do you get the impression that though this may come back up before the Michigan City School Board, and maybe if things are better planned at this time, that it might actually pass maybe the second time around?
It's possible. I think Delaney, though, you know, he seems to be under the impression that he'd like the state Department of Health and the State Board of Education to have a database in place, and that is the plan at this point. The State Department and State Board of Health and State Health Department, they will have a database in place, and until they do, that's going to be on Michigan City to have their own database. Mm-hmm. And I think he was a little concerned about the cost of that. They're not a wealthy school district by any means.
No. We're talking with Lauren Cross, who's a reporter, a writer for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about the stories that that she's covered and posted online, as well as had printed in the newspaper. And Lauren, as always, thank you for spending time with us on the program today, and hope to have you back on again soon.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Time to check in with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. She's a very busy person these days, in particular about one place that she has been spending a lot of time, and that is the Indiana State Fairgrounds. And Lieutenant Governor Crouch, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my goodness. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Well, we know that the state fair is underway. They're going to be continuing on till the through the 19th of August. You've already been out at the fairgrounds in Indianapolis to visit and talk with people. Give us an idea of how things are going in your estimation, and what things that you've been covering since you are in charge of Indiana's Department of Agriculture.
Well, thank you. Yes, as Secretary of Agriculture and Rural Development, it is my favorite time of the year, being at the state fair, being able to enjoy interacting with people from ag, our ag partners. And as you know, agriculture is a big contributor to Indiana's thriving economy, contributing $31 billion to our gross domestic product. So, you know, when I go out to the fair and I interact with people in agriculture, it is really the best that Indiana has to offer. These people are the salt of the earth. They're the people that put food on our tables and feed people all over the globe. And so, of course, the theme this year is Step Right Up. It's the circus theme, and I had the opportunity to visit the Big Top Circus on opening day. Had pork breakfast, been to Animal Farm, which is a new feature where people can actually interact with the animals that are there at the fair. You know, I mean, I've kind of been eating my way across State Fair, so there's something for everyone.
A lot of people do that, so that's the nice thing. You can go to the state fair and you can just about find every single meal that you would ever want to imagine eating at the fair there in the Midway. So that's the idea, is to take advantage of the great things. And I know a lot of these are items that are put together by people that grown and operated in Indiana. In fact, that was one of the projects or days coming up here at the fair. We know that the Lieutenant Governor has a specific celebration of Agriculture Day, as well as you get a chance to participate in the Indiana Grown activities as well, too. Tell us about those two projects, please.
Well, Indiana Grown is a branding project, a branding program that was instituted by the Indiana State Department of Agriculture. And what we do is we brand products that are grown, produced, or processed here in Indiana. So we connect those products to the consumer through shelves in stores or through farmers markets, through any number of opportunities, because the consumer truly is interested in what they are consuming these days. They have confidence that those products that are produced and grown and processed in Indiana are good products. And so we feature all of our Indiana, not all, but many of our Indiana-grown products at our Indiana-grown marketplace at the State Fair. And we have, this program was started some 3 years ago and has already 1,200-plus members.
Wow.
There's no cost to belong. But when you do belong, then the Indiana State Department of Agriculture will promote and help market your products and connect you to the consumers that are interested in purchasing them. So it's been a successful program, and I would encourage everyone who's visiting the State Fair to go to the Indiana Grown Marketplace and experience the best of what Indiana has to offer. Oh, well, the Celebration of Agriculture,
yeah.
You know, that is an opportunity to really showcase what we have to offer in Indiana, whether we do it through our exhibits, whether we do it through our interactions, you know, and the circus theme runs throughout the fair this year. The Girl Scouts have a circus theme. When you go to the exhibit halls, they all have a circus theme. And here is what I learned, which I didn't know, that Indiana was one of the states that had more winter circus farms than any other state in the country, because of our rail, because of us being centrally located. We had many communities throughout the state that actually served as winter headquarters for circuses throughout the United States. And so we have a rich history in circus here in Indiana, and we're celebrating it at the State Fair this year.
That's
so
right.
Step right up and come out and enjoy all that we have to offer at the Indiana State Fair.
Well, certainly the people in Peru, which is, I know, that of course, that's where the Circus Museum is located. It's open, I think, all year round, and they do very special things during the summer months, too, up there. But it's interesting that they should bring that theme to Indianapolis and expand it through the fair this year in particular. One of the other things I'd like to ask about, too, is the latest announcement that came out from the Department of Agriculture about the distribution of funds for 11 regional food banks, including the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. Tell us about that, please.
You know, being able to feed the hungry throughout Indiana, and it's hard for many of us to believe that there are families that go hungry and there are children that go hungry throughout Indiana. And so our food banks serve as a opportunity to get food to those individuals, and the state supports it with a $300,000 grant to our food banks to allow them to help feed those people and meet that need that is out there in Indiana. We will work to hopefully increase that in the future, but we are happy to be able to provide some assistance to our food banks. They are serving such an incredibly important need here in the state of Indiana. And I am particularly excited about coming up and visiting your new food bank in Merivale, which you were telling me about earlier.
That's right. The food bank is relocated from its old location in Gary into a big, big, big place, much bigger than I think that they could ever imagine, but they need the space. They're on Broadway in Merivale, so it's worth checking out. And they worked very hard and continuing to work hard on their campaign to raise money to be able to do what they want to do with the facility and to help people out, and the food bank in particular helping out the food pantries that they service here in Northwest Indiana. One of the other things, getting back to farmers here and the farm theme during the State Fair, is the latest situation involving the U.S. Tariff situation and the impact that it has on farmers here in Indiana. Tell us the latest, if you will.
Well, as you know, we are extremely concerned about the tariff talk and the effect that will have on our Indiana agricultural exports, because we export the majority of our agriculture products, and that serves as a marketplace for our products and for our farmers. And so we want trade, not aid. We want to know that we have markets open and available, that we can freely trade our products. And so we are appreciative that those agreements that are 30-some years old need to be modernized. We understand the need for that, but it is working, and we don't want to end up with anything that penalizes and further stresses our Indiana agriculture farmers. So we continue to communicate with our trade representatives and our congressional partners, letting them know. In fact, it was done as recently as the pork breakfast last week, mm-hmm. letting them know the importance of having free trade and being able to have those markets available for our Indiana agriculture products. We are hopeful that this will resolve in an action that is beneficial to us, but we will continue to advocate. In fact, I am meeting, I think it's next week, with our Undersecretary of Trade, our former Indiana State Department of Agriculture Director, Ted McKinney, mm-hmm. and I will anxiously look forward to hearing what he has to share on our trade situation and the tariff situation.
And finally, Lieutenant Governor Crouch, let's get an update here. I know recently the information came out at a very special Indiana Supreme Court opioid symposium, and I know that you and Governor Holcomb have been working extra hard in the battle against opioid addiction and the crisis that Indiana faces. Tell us a little bit more about this opioid symposium that was recently held and the efforts that the state government's trying to do to fight the battle.
Well, the reason is our fourth pillar. We have five pillars that we believe will take Indiana to the next level. And they are about enriching Hoosiers' lives and putting people first. And our fourth pillar is fighting the opioid epidemic, because we can't allow our citizens and our Hoosiers to fall further into the clutches of despair. We have to fight it on all levels, prevention, enforcement, and treatment. And we are doing that. Governor Holcomb's first day in office, he named a drug czar, Jim McClellan, who's hit the ground running. One out of five Hoosiers face mental illness or are suffering from addiction. And it is the leading cause of Americans under the age of 50. So these symposiums that we are having all over the state are bringing stakeholders together and individuals together to dedicate resources, all hands on deck, to be able to resolve this issue and to resolve this problem, because that's what it's going to take. I was so touched to be able to hear the story of a woman, Shirley Wagner, who lost her grandson due to the opioid addiction. And it was heartrending and touching. And she said she was there because she doesn't want other families to go through what they have gone through. That is the kind of dedication and commitment we are seeing all over the state. And it's going to take everyone if we're going to defeat this enemy. This issue affects every socioeconomic and age group. We're seeing mothers give birth to babies that are addicted. We are seeing people test positive at work, or employers can't hire people because they can't pass drug tests. So it is one of our top priorities, and we are facing this issue with our fellow Hoosiers, and we will be successful, but only because we will all be dedicated and committed to defeating this enemy.
Lieutenant Governor Crouch, thank you very much for spending time with us, telling us the latest about these topics of interest that come out of Indianapolis. And I guess it's not too trite to say we'll see you at the state fairground sometime, I would imagine.
Well, step right up.
That's Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We've gotten word in today that Governor Eric Holcomb and Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson met with U.S. Steel President and CEO David Burritt, and they in turn had a joint announcement this morning of plans to make some significant upgrades at the Gary Works steelmaking plant. Burritt said that the $750 million asset revitalization investment, as he called it, will increase efficiencies at the facility and also better the position for long-term success in Indiana. The plan calls for the installation of some new state-of-the-art production equipment, machinery, and some modernizing technology that Burritt says will serve their customers better, at the automotive as well as the energy, industrial, metal building components, home construction, appliance, and the container industries, products that the U.S. Steel plant serves. Gary Common Council President Ron Brewer said in the announcement that the multi-million-dollar investment demonstrates U.S. Steel's renewed commitment to its workers and to the city of Gary, and he said that the council looks forward to strengthening its relationship for the betterment of the community. The state of Indiana will offer U.S. Steel Corporation up to $10 million in conditional tax credits over a 10-year period, and that is based on the company's commitment to retain 3,875 Hoosier jobs in Gary. And the offer of the tax credits is still also subject to the review of the Indiana State Budget Committee. In studio is Ken Davidson, who's the creator and publisher of the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog. He's known for keeping a close eye on what governmental agencies do in Northwest Indiana, along with many other people who are civic-minded people, to say the least, and certainly ones who want to be sure that the public know about what is going on. We'll find out more here about the complaint that he has filed in court, but the questions that have come up lately here deal with whether the public really knows as much as they should know. And this is up to the point now, of course, during the public comment period and now afterward, about the expansion that's planned on the South Shoreline. In particular, I guess we're talking about mostly the West Lake expansion, which is the line that is proposed that will come south from Hammond, come down to as far south as Dyer, and then of course the double tracking, which is also planned between Gary and Michigan City, is part of the route as well too. Ken, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, for folks that are not familiar necessarily with the blog, tell us how you got started with that and where you've got it up to now.
So about 5 years ago, I just started writing a little bit. I had some spare time. I was actually going through a medical crisis with my mother and taking her to a lot of doctor's appointments and things like that. And so I took my iPad and just started writing. And over the course of the 5 years, through lots of trials and tribulations and admitted mistakes and different things, we've grown to about 30,000 followers and published, I don't know how many, millions and millions of page views. So
it's probably difficult to name what a typical reader of the blog would be or would be like here, but what would you say that the typical person that checks into the blog to find out what you put in there is?
I don't collect any demographics on anyone that comes, you know, that's one of the things that I just don't do. I guess I should, and people that market these types of things. You know, I had somebody take a look recently, some great guys out of St. John took a look, and they said, well, you're not capturing any of this information that would be valuable. And I said, yeah, I just don't, not interested in that. I have so much other things on my plate, so many other things on my plate. I don't have time to deal with the marketing end of it. So,
what kind of reaction do you get from some of your blog readers about what you put out there?
Well, it's interesting because the reaction is always instant, and oftentimes it's either, you know, and that's why I say many mistakes. I mean, the people will keep you in line, basically. And if you're responsive to that, then you'll get to a point, I think, where there's an equilibrium and you are expressing the things that are important to people. Not necessarily that they want to hear, but that are important to people. And if you can, over time, one of the things that I've done in response to reader comments and things like that is, if you take a look at my articles, I try to have them contain at least as much data from original sources as they do my own words. And so incorporated within the articles, and then at the end of the article, I always try to include the source materials. I encourage people to read the source materials as much as possible.
And I know that in particular in some of the postings that you have had lately that kind of got my attention that I wanted to talk with you about here is the issue that is dealing with the expansion that's proposed on the South Shore Line and how the Regional Development Authority and the Transportation Board, actually the board that runs the South Shore Line, the NICTE board as people typically know it, have been reacting with the citizens about the project and keeping them informed about all the facets on there. And I know this now too, and you've brought this up, and what's ended up now in the paperwork that you filed in court is trying to get some kind of action or decision about the state law that has come about as a result of last legislative session that is making some changes in how the RDA board and how the NICTE board are run. And I guess the responsibilities that they turn over to their individual staffs to make sure that the agencies run properly. It seems very confusing, and maybe you could probably clear some of that up.
Yeah, I think it's intentionally confusing. And so year after year, the RDA board in particular has been given more and more power. And in the last legislative session, there was a broad bill, which is probably far beyond the scope of our 15-minute discussion, that provided great authority to the RDA board. One of the things that is of particular concern to me is it said that as they proceed through these projects, no other Indiana code provisions apply. And so that, in my reading of that, and I could be wrong, would be conflict of interest, public meetings, public records, any kind of oversight would not apply to them as they proceed through this process of financing what is now $764 million, one of the largest projects, which, by the way, is going to lead to other very large projects, because we know right now they're saying the TOD is going to be another $700 million. The double tracking is going to be another $300 million. So we're getting pretty close to $2 billion in expenditures, the majority of which is going to come from local sources.
And this TOD that you referred to, is the abbreviation for transit-oriented development, which is, I guess, something that goes along with the expansion of the line itself. It's talking about economic development in the neighborhoods, I guess.
Absolutely. And so the theory is that in order to make this line successful, the ridership projections, the population projections that are being used to justify the expenditure of $764 million, you are required to provide, in order to make this line successful, you need to have dense mixed-use buildings around the station areas. Mm-hmm. And so there is a comprehensive strategic plan which outlines exactly how and where they're going to do that. And there was a bill, House Bill 1144, in, I believe, 2016, that provided that the RDA could create these transit development districts within a mile of the station area. The RDA then can take all the local revenue out of that, the increases in local revenue out of those station areas up until 2047. And they can use that to put back into the area for development of these dense mixed-use areas. That's really the part of it that I think people are not getting and don't understand at this point because they haven't gotten a lot of information on it.
In respect of these districts, do you get the impression that it's additional taxes or it's some of the taxes that perhaps residents or businesses may pay to the cities where they're located that will have to go back in?
It absolutely is. The transit development districts will work similar to how a tax increment financing works now, except that they will take all increments of property tax, local option income tax, state sales tax, and state income tax. So the two sources that our locals rely on primarily for funding, which are your local property taxes and your local option income tax, those are going to sort of dry up. They're not going to see any increases, let's say, over the next 30 years. But also we are, at this point, we're demolishing buildings at a record pace within those transit development districts.
Are we noticing any, I guess, questions that come out here that citizens have made? Are they making these kind of questions known during the public comment period when NICTI was asking citizens for their view as they were trying to explain what the projects were all about?
There's a group that has become somewhat vocal, and that is the Westlake Corridor residents, the NICTI Westlake Corridor residents. They're based in Hammond and Munster. I think people feel somewhat powerless. There was a Munster meeting that became very contentious. It was, you know, some of these meetings were very well attended. Having your comment that you oppose the project published in a report that goes to the federal government doesn't really seem like something that helps people a lot.
Mm-hmm. It's. I guess a better opportunity for citizens to make their comments known to the boards themselves or the representatives of the boards. But you think that there should be more that should be made, at least the information should get to at least to Indianapolis, if it doesn't get to Washington, D.C.?
Well, it's in the final environmental impact statement. Mm-hmm. You can see the comments in there. About, according to the statistics that they published, about 10% of the comments were opposed to the project. About 15% were in favor of the project, and then they had different categories of comments, some of which I think if you analyze them, many of which show that the people making them are opposed. Also, the residents of the Westlake Corridor Residents Group published one letter, which then counted, even though there were hundreds of people that signed on to it, counted as one comment, which drove that 10% number down. Mm-hmm. But those comments are all published. They're available online on the final environmental impact statement. So, yes, they have gone to Washington. Whether they have any impact or not is, again, another question.
I guess the other question, because something you mentioned about the fact that the public has some input, they've had some input, but there apparently have been, I guess the impression I get that there have been changes or at least reviews of things as the process is moving along. We're talking in particular about the fact that, of course, there has to be federal funding for the project. That's part and parcel of all of this, and it has to go on to for approval in Washington. But this information gets back to the local boards, in this case in particular to the NICTI board, and I suppose even to the RDA board, since they're working with NICTI on the project for the financial end of it. If things don't get bad, if things are kept updated, if they keep updates to them as to what things are doing or what isn't being done, that they're knowing, okay, this paperwork is moving through at this particular pace, the public should know as much or should know more, if shouldn't.
That's correct. Absolutely. And so one of the things that is a major contention right now is not whether or not there's going to be federal funding. That's a contention too, but I accept that there most likely will be. I anticipate that there will be. But there is a real question as to whether or not that funding is going to come in at 20% or 50%. Now, in a $764 million project, that's over $100 million, over $200 million difference in federal funding. And my question is, what say are the residents going to have, and when will we know that that money is going to come out of our pockets? And it all comes out of our pocket. Let's face it. It's federal money or local money. But, you know, it's they're going to need more of a local match if, in fact, it comes back federally financed at 20%. I don't think they're going to stop the project. I think they'll push it through, but, you know, find another way to fund it.
In your paperwork that you filed with the county circuit court, you talk, I guess, in particular, I guess, or making point that you wanted some kind of determination from a judge who's going to review this as to whether the boards involved, and we're talking, I guess, the RDA board and the NICTI board, are doing things as they should and following through and letting the public know, or at least certainly keeping the media aware, which they have, but to even more so about how things are coming along. That's the impression that you get just by looking at the complaint. Is that one of your intents?
Sure. And so let me first let's go back, and I do want to make one point with regard to public record requests. The public access counselor has chastised RDA for not being responsive to public record requests in the past. Numerous public record requests are pending, delayed. It's very difficult to get information from them. But I do want to, if we could, and I know we're limited on time, mm-hmm. read the two paragraphs. There's just two simple paragraphs that I think are in contention here. The is that all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
The state statute creates a board which is supposed to do certain things, and that board is appointed by the governor and our local elected officials. And so in Section 3 of NICTI Resolution 1801, which I have right on the Gazette if you want to take a look at it, it's also on the RDA website. So it's in in.gov/RDA, and it's right there on the front page. The board approves and authorizes the execution of the governance agreement attached hereto in substantially final form as Exhibit 8, which outlines the roles and responsibilities among and between the parties related to the financing, development, acquisition, construction, operation, and maintenance of the projects, including the financing plan established in including the financing plan in the form of Exhibit 5 of the governance agreement, subject to the understanding that certain approvals with respect to the double-track project will need to be provided by the parties in the future before the double-track project is approved. The chair and or the chief executive officer are authorized to execute and deliver the governance agreement and financing agreements in such form, and here's where we get into the what I think is an issue here, with such changes, additions, and deletions to form and substance as they approve, but materially consistent with the intent of the form attached. So there's a contract, and what they're saying is, we'll sign this contract, and you just go ahead and change it however you want in the future. Yeah. Those contracts, I'm alleging at least, need to be signed in a public forum by the public bodies that are designated to sign those.
So I get the impression that the complaint that you filed is just basically asking for some judicial guidance and maybe not wrapping knuckles or anything like that, but at least mentioning that these judges saying that these things should happen and they should be done in the public purview and these should be brought up in more public viewing.
Absolutely. I would analogize it to some extent to challenges that have been made to President Trump's executive orders. We haven't seen much pushback from local leaders on this, and I'm surprised at that. But I know a couple days ago you had Spiros Batistatos on speaking about the convention center and sort of singing the praises of the RDA in relation to what they've done thus far on the convention center. But let's assume for a second that in 2020 we got a different governor who was opposed to the expenditure of public funds for a convention center. Now, we've already spent X amount of dollars moving forward, right? And we would get a new head of the RDA who could then, and let's assume that not one person in Lake County voted for this governor. Let's assume that every vote that this governor got came from Indianapolis and Fowler and Jeffersonville and areas, Evansville, throughout the state, right? Not one person in Lake County voted for this governor. But that governor could appoint somebody who could completely nix our convention center, even though we've spent $1 million moving forward. That process doesn't seem to be the way local representative government works, right?
That's the question that comes up here, and we're going to have to bring this up for another conversation, I think, here, which I knew this would happen, but that's fine, too. Ken Davidson is the person who's created and runs the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog, and he's been addressing some of the questions that come up about whether the public has had enough the opportunity to talk about these projects, in particular the projects that we've kind of focused in so far on the South Shore Line. And Ken, thank you for spending some time with us. And talking a little bit about the complaint that you filed in court, and we'll have you back to talk again soon.
Thank you so much.
A Supreme Court decision in June allowed states to charge a sales tax on vendors who don't have a physical presence in the state. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Isaiah Seibert reports that the State Department of Revenue isn't quite sure how the decision will affect the state's finances.
Department Commissioner Adam Krupp thinks he was invited to the State Budget Committee's August meeting to talk about how much revenue the court's decision in South Dakota versus Wayfair will bring in. But he says he doesn't have an answer.
There are all kinds of predictions. Lots of numbers have been thrown out all across the country. A word of caution is sort of prudent here because we don't know the universe of all of these remote sellers outside of Indiana.
The state has a law on the books that levies a 7% sales tax on remote vendors that surpass certain transaction minimums. But the law's constitutionality was challenged in court prior to the Supreme Court decision. That case is still pending resolution. The state is telling remote vendors that the tax will go into effect October 1st if the court approves it, which Krupp believes will happen. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Isaiah Seibert.
On this week's Shelf Discovery, Kristen faces her fears with author Courtney Harmeister's Okay, Fine, Whatever.
Get ready to step outside your comfort zone, because this week's Discovery follows an author on a quest to overcome anxiety. Thanks for tuning in to this week's Shelf Discovery. I'm your host, Kristen Dreyer Kramer, from nightsandweekends.com. Each day, many of us are forced to face our fears, big or little, in order to go about our daily tasks. For author Courtney Harmeister, every day was once an endless cycle of fear and anxiety, until she decided to face up to her fears and write about her adventures in Okay, Fine, Whatever. The story follows a comedy writer and former radio host in a year-long quest to do things that made her incredibly uncomfortable. Since she suffers from an anxiety disorder, she avoided a lot of things in life. But after one especially debilitating panic attack, she realized that it was time to make some changes. As she took her life in a new direction, she decided to take on a new project, called her Okay, Fine, Whatever Project, in which she would spend a year doing all of the things that scared her. Okay, Fine, Whatever follows the author as she attempts to break out of her shell and try something new, like spending time in a sensory deprivation tank. And she explains each adventure in the most candid of ways. She may suffer from anxiety, but her style is anything but weak. Her voice comes shining through, and you can't help but love her openness, her completely natural sense of humor, and her sometimes brutal honesty. Still, while readers might be expecting more wild and crazy adventures through Portland, much of the book focuses on relationships. Through years of anxiety and struggles with her weight, Hameister shied away from relationships. So, during her year-long project, she decided to set up an online dating profile and go on a whole lot of first dates. But while the stories of her dating experiences are often comical, they seem to take up a little too much space. But is it worth facing your fears with this anxious author? On a scale of buy it, borrow it, or don't bother, I say borrow it. The anecdotes and adventures come together to teach the author valuable lessons about trying something new. The project helped her take more chances, and reading about it could just do the same for others, too. Or, if nothing else, it's at least good for some laughs. Well, it looks like we've come to the last page of this week's Shelf Discovery. Okay, Fine, Whatever by Courtney Hameister is 234 frank and witty pages long and is available from Little Brown & Company. For more information, along with show archives and even more reviews, visit shelfdiscovery.org and nightsandweekends.com. And feel free to send any questions, comments, or recommendations my way at books@shelfdiscovery.org. Until next time, wherever the week may take you, don't forget to bring a book.
Dedicated to helping busy readers wade through the shelves and shelves of options to discover books that are worth their often limited reading time, Shelf Discovery can be heard here on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM as Kristen Dreyer Kramer offers listeners a brief look inside the pages of a new book. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. And for this week, I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much for being with us. And our thanks to Lauren Cross with the Times of Northwest Indiana and Ken Davidson with the Northwest Indiana Gazette and to Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. We will be back with you on Monday.